Would this be a good year for you to grow spiritually? Would it? For you guys to just, with me, just to go to another place spiritually that maybe you've never been before. In order to do that, it's possible, no, it's likely, that we'll have to do things we've never done in order to go places we've never been. But we can't keep doing the same thing we're doing and then think we're going to get a sudden rise in our spiritual growth. We're probably going to have to make some changes. Not these are drastic changes, but they might be welcome changes. One, I'm coming to the place where I'm beginning to think that in order to grow spiritually, you and I will have to rediscover our hunger. We were hungry once. But many of us have forgotten what we are hungry for because we have chased after it with too many other things. And the things that we have chased after a hunger, and by hunger, I just mean a deep, incurable longing in our hearts for something more. Something of God. We feel that. It's like a phantom pain, something that used to be there and is not there anymore, but it still hurts. And we chase after that phantom pain with different things. And so some of us have stuffed ourselves empty. Our lives are full, but our souls are still hungry. Wouldn't this be a good year to find that hunger and feed it? Church, would it? So all of this now brings me to Isaiah 55. I'm just intrigued by Isaiah 55 because it describes a banquet. Here's the backstory. In the book of Isaiah, which is a collection of sermons, the prophet has said that Israel has broken the terms of the covenant she had with Yahweh. And because of this, Yahweh was going to send her into exile, into bondage, captivity in Babylon. But he would not leave her there. While she was in bondage, Israel began to question everything she knew about God. She didn't know if he was who he said he was, if Israel was who God said she was. She didn't know what it meant to believe anymore, and she didn't know how things worked anymore. But in her darkest hour, Yahweh, who carried her, didn't send her, carried her into exile and stayed there with her, would lead her out with the help of a servant. Isaiah says the servant is a critical figure in Israel's return. This servant would be an unusual leader who led in an unprecedented way. This servant would not be overpowering. He would be quiet, humble. He would not lord his authority over the nation. He would rather absorb the sins of the nation and take them unto himself. So this servant would not call people to die for him. He would die for the people. Israel had never seen a leader like this before. That's a different kind of king. Chapter 55 in Isaiah portrays a banquet. that God is calling the people of God to come and celebrate the coming of this servant. When he comes, we're all going to eat. Now, a couple things are really clear to me, and I have to point these out at the very beginning because I don't want you to miss them. One is that the words in Isaiah 55 are an invitation. They are not a command. This is critical because how many grew up in church? Yeah, okay, most of us. If you grew up in church, your tendency is to think of the words of God as commands, which is like God saying, do this, stop that. So you think of the words of Jesus as commands. Forgive your enemies. Do it. Do not lust. Stop it. Do not worry. Stop it. Forgive your enemies. Do it. You see it? But if these are commands, then the onus is on you to perform these commands. But if these are invitations, then the onus is on God to do what he's asking you to do. So you think of the words of Jesus not so much as a fence. Stay out of that. Don't go there. You think of the words as a gateway, which is saying, here is a better, beautiful, good, true life. Step into it. Are you still there? This is a massive internal shift from a moral base to a wisdom base. If the Bible is a book of morality, and it is, it's never either or, then the question is what's right and what's wrong, and the punishment for wrong is hell. But if the Bible is a book of wisdom, then the question isn't just what's right and wrong, it's what is good? What is true? What is the beautiful life? And how do I get some? You see that? And the punishment for breaking it or walking away from it is what you miss out on. It's what you forfeit, what you lose. So the first thing is, the words of Isaiah are an invitation. Come, all who are thirsty. Come to the water and drink. Come, you who have no money, and buy wine and milk. You hear it? Church, do you hear it? You get into listening mode, and it scares me. It makes me a performer, and I hate that. So are you tracking now? So that's the first thing. This is an invitation. It's not a command. You don't have to do any of this if you don't want to. Whew. You'll miss it, but you don't have to. Second, this is for anybody. But it's not for everybody. Anybody can come, but there are people who self-select out. What is striking about this invitation in Isaiah 55 and why it's grabbed hold of me is because in, in chapter 54, the prophet is describing who is on the invite list, who gets the invitation. And if you back up to chapter 54, listen to the list of invitees, people. It's the woman who is barren and never bore a child, verse 1. It's the child who never had a daddy, a father, because was abandoned, verse 1. It's the invisible, the untouchable people who sit on the streets of the city in shame and in disgrace, in verse 4. It's the widow whose spouse has died, verse 5. It's the woman who married young and her husband deserted her, verse 7. It's the person who feels that God has abandoned them, verse 8. It's the people who suffer the oppression of a tyrant leader, verse 14. What all of them have in common is shame. These are not ordinary people. These are below ordinary people. Every last one of them bear a mark that that society, that first century culture considered a taboo. Now I gotta write. What they all have in common, every one of them, is they're broken. Every one of them on the invite list. There's one other thing. They're all hungry. Here is a community of misfit people invited to a feast that God is putting on for broken people. And when you get in chapter 55, verse 1 and 2, you find out it's not only people that feel like they don't fit in college church, it's people who do feel like they fit because they're accomplished and they're professional and they're advanced and they're educated, and some of them have money, but in chapter 55, it says they have been spending their money on things that do not satisfy them. They buy every shiny new thing, and the best day of ownership is the day they bought it. But after they've had it a while, it's not fun anymore, and they don't know why, and in a strange way, they are broken people, but they have enough to cover it up. The question is, are they all hungry? Are you still there? The pastoral moment in this is to say, if you're feeling like you don't fit in a circle of religious people because there's something different about you, wrong with you, and if the rest of this room heard about that, but I mean, that would be a source of shame and ridicule for me. What I want you to know is those are the qualifications for getting in. You're thinking that those are the things that keep you out. Those are actually the things that get you invited, but you gotta be hungry. You gotta want it. You gotta remember what you're hungry for. Now, the prophet never tells us what this richest affair, wine and milk, well, we're Wesleyans, milk, really is. But when I get into the Gospels in John chapter 7, I see Jesus on the last and greatest day of the feast pick up prophet's words, and he pulls them into himself. On the feast of of the booths or the Feast of Tabernacles, as it was called. It was 7 days long, and every day the priest would go to the Pool of Siloam, take a golden pitcher of water, march up to the temple steps, pour out the water on the base of the steps to signify how God provided water in the desert from a rock. Remember that? Remember that? This whole feast, a week long, is a reenactment of the wandering in the wilderness, the way that we kind of reenact at Mississinewa. You know what I'm talking about? Well, it's a little different, like a lot different, but that's what this was. It was the 7-day reenactment of the Israelites wandering in the wilderness. And so the ritual had meaning. It was saying God has the power to provide things that we can't provide. And the things he provides, water, are things you can't live without. And on the last day of the feast, the priest would do the same thing 7 times. And the scripture says, while the priest was doing this, Jesus got up and said, all who are thirsty, come to me and drink. John said he meant the Holy Spirit. He said, those who come to me and drink, out of their belly will flow rivers of living water. This is a striking thing. The prophet is offering them a drink, and Jesus is offering them the whole river. Jesus is saying, you will become the river if you come to me and drink. But you gotta be thirsty. You got to be thirsty, or this doesn't apply. You can't drink if you're already satiated. Are you still tracking? I started reading in the Gospel of John the different things that Jesus promised. If you obey my commandments, you really are my disciples. And then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. John chapter 8, 31, 32. And those whom the Son sets free are free indeed. How many of us are free? The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. But I have come that they might have, help me, life, and have it in abundance. How many of us can say, oh, I got that? My peace I give to you, not as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Do not be afraid. How many of us can say, John 14, verse 27, I have in my soul that kind of peace. I have said these things to you so that your joy may be complete and my joy may be in you. John 15, how many of us would say, oh yeah, man, got that in spades. I have the joy of Jesus Christ inside of me. When he comes, the Spirit that is, he will guide you into all truth. You'll be able to discern, said Jesus in John chapter 16. And how many of us could say, this is a regular occurrence for me? I have conversations with God. I hear his voice. I know that it's God and not my own voice. And I step into that obediently. And my obedience becomes another form of interpretation. The more I obey, the more I understand. And the more I understand, the more I obey. Yeah, that is my, how many of us would say, that is exactly where I'm living? You don't have to answer that now. Where I'm going with this is that most, I'm thinking of it like this. I did this with the staff, only not about spirituality. I did it about careers. I think careers do the same thing, but I'm talking about spirituality now. This is a line graph, in case you're wondering. Over on the side, I've got the word energy. So the energy is high when it's here. Are you there? Are you tracking? Yeah, and then down here is time. And what I noticed is when a person first becomes a follower of Jesus Christ, there is an immediate spike in their energy. And what's driving it is hunger. They want to know more about who he is. They want to be rid of things that keep weighing them down, ruining their lives. They're willing to take risks. They're highly adaptive. They're very transparent. They confess things openly and sincerely. These people that just come to Christ experience this sudden spike in energy. But then I've noticed after about the first year or so, these things sort of taper off. A year? And they spend so much of the rest of their lives in this little state right here. Somewhere in between the invitations of Jesus and going to hell. We have just enough habits to maintain a spiritual life that is steady, but most of us have a hard time breaking out of this. Are you tracking? Again, I'm not asking you to self-evaluate. Some years ago, Barna's done the same kind of thing. He found 10 different marks along the spiritual pathway. And what Barna said, self-reported, by the way, not foisting his things, self-reported. He said about 40 to 50% of all evangelical Christians, these are Christians, not just church people, he said, live in this realm right down in here. He said, those who live above the line here is 1%. Number 9 is they love God as much as they love themselves. And number 10 is they love other people as much as they love themselves. 1% of all people, he said, live in that realm of abundance. So you can see the problem. If we were to attend the invitation, how do we do that? I have a simple formula. 1, it begins with hunger. There's got to be hunger. Plus, we got to have a strategy. We have to have a plan for actually becoming like Jesus. Are you there? Plus, we have to have some accountability. Then we will have spiritual growth. Part of this only you can do as individuals. Nobody can make us hungry. We either are or we are not. And as I say, most of our trouble is we forgot that we are because we've settled for other things. And we've normalized things in this bracket. There are things we used to want at the very beginning of our spiritual lives, and after years when we don't get them, we tell ourselves that must be the way it's supposed to be. But your hunger tells you more, doesn't it? You know that's not true because you still want it. And the fact that you want it is proof it exists. And yet we compromise. We middle out. And every 3 or 4 years, we cycle into a mini revival, then down again, then another little revival, then down again. Then comes a new pastor, and then he wears off. And then there's a whole new program, and then that's gone. We do this again and again. And we give in to impulsive behaviors. And we spend so much of our lives negotiating the shame and the guilt that comes from wanting what we were supposed to want, but never being able to get it. So the part that we must come to the table with, church, is hunger. My question for you this morning is, are you really hungry? The strategy part, the staff has thought about this a long time. This is 3 or 4 months worth of deliberating. If I were to do it, I'd do it like this. We think that there's 4 parts to a strategy. And I'll tell you how let me tell you first how we got there. By going into the Gospels, we're not asking ourselves, what did Jesus do to disciple people? Because that's just a series of inputs. We're asking ourselves, how did people actually get discipled? What actually happened in the Gospels when people's lives changed? Does that make sense? Yes? So we see 4 elements. One of those is an encounter. Every person who changes in the gospel begins with an encounter with Jesus Christ. Sometimes he seeks them, sometimes they seek him. But everything changes when they meet him. Now, it doesn't always get better. Some people get worse. But what never happens is people meet Jesus and just stay the same. That doesn't happen. It's like watching lightning strike. Even if it doesn't hit you, you remember where you were when you saw it. And it divides the audience. We either become more fond of him or we become less fond of him based on our dispositions at the time. But everything happens when Jesus and people meet. There, that encounter is always followed up with an engagement. After the disciples watch Jesus speak in public, then they walk with Jesus on the road and they start to argue and they dispute. And I mean, they're questioning Jesus' teachings. And sometimes in churches, we think of this as a negative thing. These people are disciples and they're arguing with Jesus. He must not be Lord. But actually, when you look at it, the argument, the dispute, the fighting amongst themselves with Jesus in the midst is part of the growing process. Why are we so afraid of disputing the teachings of Jesus? We ought to be able to get in a room and say, these things are not hard. These are impossible. We can't do these things. Because it's in wrestling with his teachings, we begin to absorb them and take them seriously. Otherwise, we just rehearse them and just say, well, I believe that because I'm supposed to. But it's not the same thing. Then after that, man, I don't have great words for this. There is this season of belonging or bonding where Jesus takes the people who are following him and he starts putting them together with people who are not their people. Walking along the way, they say, we saw a man casting out demons and he wasn't one of us, so we told him to stop. And Jesus said, you stop. Those who aren't for us, I mean, those who aren't against us are for us. In John chapter 10, he says, I have sheep that don't belong to this fold. So there's this third component where Jesus has taken this band of disciples and pulling them into an entity that is larger and older and more diverse and more sustainable than their little club. And so this we call church. This is what Paul means when he says, serve one another, pray for one another, admonish one another, teach one another, encourage one another, build one another up. Are you tracking? All of this has to do with the body of Christ being built up. Are you there? And then the last one, now that I haven't erased everything, is mission. The entire trajectory of the Gospels is Jesus collecting disciples, building them up, immersing them in a body that is bigger than their club, and then he releases them onto the world. Luke 10 is a powerful example of this because he releases 72, not 12. The 12 in chapter 9 are the clergy, but the 72 in Luke 10 are all laity. And the power that these laity have is astonishing. They will cast out demons and heal the sick. You there? So in College Church, what we tried to do is to design a structure around these things. We think this is worship. We think this is meeting together. This is your classes. How many of you are in classes after this is over? You're going to go to class. Really, raise your hand. Oh, why so few? I'm not going to beat on it. I'm just going to say, I think the tendency of many is I'm going to come on Sunday and I'm going to have an encounter. But then I look at people, we have no way to break that down. Who are you disputing this with? Who's having that conversation with you? Well, no, I'm just going to hear it and do it. You can't. You have to reason with somebody in order to see how to do that. This over here, we call serving together. How many of you currently are involved in some ministry within College Church? Can I see your hands again? Beautiful. Gosh, from the bottom of my heart, thank you, man. You're what make this place hum. But part of spiritual growth is going another level into that if you're not currently doing it. And then finally, we call this going together or some kind of ministry out there in the public that is not in College Church. Are you there? So we're tracking. We're starting to build the chassis, the infrastructure that allow people to grow. We're starting to build a strategy. What we have no control over is the hunger. Let me come down again. If you're thinking that somehow your life is so broken that you could never really grow, you are the candidate. If you're a person whose past is like dotted with failure, or there are things about you that this culture, the religious one I mean, has sort of forgotten and pushed aside, you're a candidate. These things do not disqualify you. They're why you get invited. The only people who cannot come, who cannot grow, are those who have already had enough. But if you have not had enough, if you're transparent enough and courageous enough and willing to do stuff you've never done before, then there is an invitation by God Himself open to you. In the next few weeks, we're going to walk through that together.